Good morning. Good morning. All right. So far we have discussed, you know, the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics for systems with finite number of degrees of freedom. They corresponded, you know, to how many generalized coordinates we use. And so now we will shift gears and do something more complicated. We will discuss the classical field theories. And so in the field theory, actually, you have suddenly you pop out infinite number of degrees of freedom. And of course, there is a very nice prototype of a classical field theory, which is the Maxwell's electrodynamics or Maxwell's theory. And another prototype of a classical field theory would be general relativity. And so as you will be learning relativity, you will see that these two theories go actually exactly parallel to each other. And then whatever you see, you know, is true in Maxwell's theory will be true in the Einstein's theory of general relativity and so on. And you can really compare, you know, the concepts are exactly the same and the field equations are very similar and the identities are very similar. So if you actually understand Maxwell's theory very well, then you know, everything basically is happening the same in general relativity as well. So, so what is a classical field theory? And the idea is very simple in some sense, is that, well, before classical field theory, there was this Newton's action at a distance, right? So we had two bodies which acted on themselves by the force law due to Newton, and they acted immediately and whatever, and there was like an action at distance, so it happened immediately, but also it happened at an arbitrary distance. And so we know this is not the case, so instead, you actually replace the action at a distance with a local action where you interact, you know, where your matter interacts with each other through the concept of the field, but it only interacts locally with the field. So basically, you shake one particle here, and then it interacts with the field, and the field propagates, and then you know this interacts with the other particle, and that's how the two particles actually interact here. So field, or maybe let's say the key concept is that the interaction is local, interaction of matter is local via the concept of field. Hello. Yeah, the concept of field, and you know, compare this. So compare with action at a distance. And so the local is really, really important. So you only locally interact with your field, and then you know the field propagates, you know, and then you again interact locally with the field. And there is no, you know, any action at a distance or whatever. And, you know, this seems to be the concept how nature works. The field theory is very, very successful. But it doesn't mean that that's the only option we have. And in fact, you know, at least for Maxwell's theory, this beautiful Feynman's-Wheeler theory, which still uses action at a distance in some sense, but it's still relativistic and it's still completely equivalent to Maxwell's theory. So just beware that although, you know, the concept of field theory really now prevails everywhere, and you know people think that's the right description. Maybe you know there are some alternatives, or maybe that's not the final word to be said here. Okay, so now what is a field?
What was the name?
Say it again. I will discuss it later, so you will see. It's so beautiful that it cannot be true, right? Anyway, so field. Is a physical quantity which you know penetrates your space and time, so you know at each point of space and time.
Thank you.
And so by saying that it's a physical quantity, I really mean that it not necessarily is just a tool for the matter to interact with each other, but it can carry its own degrees of freedom and so on. And we know that we can have some non-trivial field configurations, even in the absence of sources and stuff like that. We have electromagnetic waves, we have gravitational waves, and so on. So really, you know, the field is physical here. And so what we are really doing is basically like going from Q of t, which is what we were discussing at this point, to the field, which is a function of time, but also of space. Right? So phi plays now the role of the Q, and t is replaced by time, but also space over here. You can think about the space dependence of the field. It's like a label, and I'm talking about the field at this point of the space, right? And so it depends on both things. Okay. Very good. So now we have classical field theory. We know what the field is. So what is the structure of a typical classical field theory? And the classical field theory really, you know, has two ingredients. So the, you know, classical field theory. Typically has matter, you know, described by particles or whatever, and then it has the field, right? And because you have, and you know, this is very strange, right? So you're putting two different concepts together. So let's say I really have, you know, in my Maxwell electrodynamics, I have electrons, and I will say, well, these are point-like charge particles, and then they interact through electromagnetic field, right? I consider two different entities, like particles and fields. Of course, you know, in quantum field theory, or you know, you can replace this description through particles by another field, right? Then you will say, you know, electron is a Dirac field, right? And then it interacts, electrons interact through other field as well, right? So this thing here, the particle description. Later replaced by fields as well. But for many purposes, you know, the particle description is a good description, right? And so you can study lots of things just saying, well, electron is a point-like particle. All right, and so because we have two kinds of, you know, components of your field theory, you need two sets of equations. So then you have equations of motion, and so they, you know, you have to have both. You have field equations, which are typically the equations of motion for the field if you fix the sources. So equations of motion for field produced by sources. And this will be your Maxwell equations. But you also have to have the force law. And so these are equations of motion for matter. So, you know, given the configuration of the field, how my matter actually moves. Okay. And so these are the Maxwell equations. Maxwell equations, a prototype, and this will be the Lorentz force law. So now, of course, you know, the whole system interacts, right? And so you know, the particles, you know, move in the field, but as they move, they also affect the field and so on. So you have to solve these equations of, you know, both sets of equations simultaneously. And it's typically very, very difficult. And so that's why people don't do that. And instead, they typically choose some kind of approximation where you can only set one set of equations and so on. So very favorite, very popular approximation is that of test field approximation. Test matter approximation. In that approximation, you say that the matter you are really thinking about doesn't really produce any field. It's just, you know, too small to produce anything. and then you can just study the motion of this matter in a given, you know, field already. So when you will be discussing Mercury moving around the sun, you will just say, well, Mercury is just a particle moving in, you know, spherically symmetric potential of sun. And of course, it doesn't, it produces some gravitational field, but you can neglect that to the first order. And you know, then you can just solve, you know, basically test particle in a gravitational field of spherical. It's also popular approximation. Is that of test matter. So basically the matter is like small matter does not produce its own gravitational field or electromagnetic field. It's produce its own field and just moves in a fixed field configuration, right? But if you don't do that approximation, then you have to solve both equations simultaneously, and it's very complicated typically. In general, both sets of equations have to be solved simultaneously. And that's complicated. Okay? Yes?
Will the trajectory of the matter be affected by its own field? Like, suppose it's in a vacuum, there's nothing else.
Yeah, so we will, for example, discuss the radiation reaction force. Right, so what really happens is that, you know, if you start, let's say, accelerating your electron or whatever, because it accelerates, it produces electromagnetic radiation, it has its own field, and it starts interacting with its own field, right? And so this causes the radiation reaction force, and you know, it's complicated, right? Yeah.
What is sources in classical field theory? Can it be matter or is something outer?
So sources, very good. So that's what I mean by matter. So matter would be like a source of your electromagnetic field. It would be the electron, or, you know, for gravitational field, it would be anything that has a mass. So that would be your source. And then, you know, that produces the field, and the matter interacts through this field.
Consider everything as a field. So you're basically saying that some fields are creating the other fields.
Again, it's an interaction between fields. Yes, exactly.
So when you say both sets of equations, so like the field equations
and equations of motion for the matter,
they have to be solved simultaneously. You mean like I'm trying to think of a problem and how you go about solving it. So like I don't know, if you had, I don't know, say Mercury orbiting the sun or something.
You know, as it moves, it has its own gravitational field, right? And then this gravitational field, distorts the gravitational field of the sun, right? And so now it's sort of like moving in this new gravitational field, which is, you know, dynamical and, you know, time dependent and so on. And so you would have to be solving, like, if you want more accurate result, you would have to be solving these things. But then you always have to think, like, you know, is it worth it, right? What is the next really correction I need to find, right? And it may not be precisely this. It may be like, yeah. Maybe the next better correction is that, you know, the potential produced by sun is not spherically symmetric, or, you know, you have to think about what is really the leading correction which you need to do, rather than, you know, just trying to solve the full dynamical problem.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the general structure, okay? And so this is extremely clear and extremely simple. And as I say, you know, this structure will be true in Einstein's theory or in Maxwell's theory. So now let me jump in and you know, discuss the Maxwell theory. So Maxwell theory is the prototype. And so Maxwell equations formulated in 1860. And they just consist, well, of this beautiful set of equations. So there's an Ampere law, Ampere plus Maxwell, and that is curl of B. So now we are talking about two fields, E and B. They are vectors, and then there are some differential operators acting on these vectors. And so this is the first set of equations. And then I'm using some weird, probably Gaussian units or something like that. So there won't be any epsilon zero or mu zero or something, all these things. So it's just 4 pi, OK? And there's the constant. Or you can think about it like I'm setting lots of things equal to 1. Anyway, so that's the first set of equations. Then the second of equations is due to Faraday. And that's a curl of E plus dV over dt equals to 0. And then we have Gauss, which is the divergence of E is 4 pi rho. And then we have, again, Gauss, but for the magnetic field. But now you don't have any sources here. So now we have like two sources, right? We have two sources here. So rho is the charge density, and J is the current density. Okay, so these are equations. So this is 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the statement is the whole Maxwell theory almost is captured by these equations. Well, of course, that's not true. That's only half of the theory. So that's what you call the field equations for the field E and B, right? So we have electric field E and magnetic field B. And typically, people understand that these equations, well, given the sources J and rho, I can solve for E and B from these equations. Okay. As I said, this is only half of the theory. So the second half is the force law. So let's say, you know, how do my electrons actually move once I solve for the electric intensity E and for the B? And that's given by the Lorentz force law. So plus Lorentz, and I never know which Lorentz it is. There's two Lorentzes, okay? So one came with the gauge, Lorentz gauge, and the other one came with the force. And I'm not sure if this is correct, but this is the guy who also invented the Lorentz transformations. Hopefully it's the right Lorentz. Okay, Lorentz force law, which is beside the second set of equations. And that tells you, well, if I have an electron, you know, for a particle with charge E, the force is as follows. So dP over dt is the force. And that's given by E times E V cross B. Okay? So that's the Lorentz force law, which accompanies your Maxwell equations. And that's the second set of equations you need to be considering. Of course, if you are familiar with general relativity, what would be the analog of the Maxwell equations there? Somebody? It would be the Einstein field equations, G mu equals to T mu nu. And what would be the analog of this thing here? It would be the geodesic equation. Okay, so very good. What you will see later on is that the geodesic equation has precisely this structure. You can think about this as an expansion in small velocities. If your velocities are super small, you have electrostatics. You have time which is independent of the velocity, and it's like electrostatic force. And if you include terms linear in V, then you get this V cross B term, which is like the Lorentz force. right, due to the motion of things. But the geodesic equation will continue on, and then we'll have the corrections v squared and so on, right? But you know, the Lorentz, the geodesic equation has precisely the structure as well. You will see that. Okay, so the geodesics, Einstein's general relativity knows about electrostatics, but it also knows about electrodynamics. Okay, very good. Questions so far. So that's our beautiful Maxwell's theory.
Sorry, did you say we'll see that?
In the relativity course, not in this course. Okay, very good. So let me have two remarks. So remarks. And the first one will be about charge conservation. And in order to say anything about charge conservation, I will need to use two beautiful identities, differential, whatever. Not form identity. Well, they are differential form identities, but it doesn't matter. So you have divergence of kernel of any vector will be equal to zero. So that's for any vector v. If I do curl, so by curl, well, this is like, well, this is the gradient, right? But I do this very strange like vector cross product or something like that. So that's a curl of v. And then this is scalar product, right? So if you do gradient, well, so that's a divergence. Okay, so divergence of curl of v is equal to zero for any v. And similarly, curl of gradient of any function will be zero as well. So these are the two identities. All right. So to continue, let's apply a divergence to our first equation. So let's do the divergence on one. Okay. Well, divergence of curl is zero. So this is equal to zero. And then we have minus dE over dt, I hope. I can't see there. But we are doing the divergence. So we are doing like a, so of course this guy here acts on spatial things, right? So this is like d over, in Cartesian coordinates, the gradient will be just d over dx and d over dy and d over dz, right? So you know, it has nothing to do with time, and there's no surprise that you can swap the order of time differentiation with the phase differentiation. So I can swap these two, and so it will be minus d over dt divergence of E. Okay, and this is equal to 4 pi divergence of J. Okay, so that's super simple. But now the last thing I have to use is that I use my equation 3. So by equation 3, divergence of E is 4 pi rho. So this guy is 4 pi rho. And so now looking at your equation here, you see that basically d rho over dt, so from here, you see that d rho over dt plus divergence of j equals to zero, which is called continuity equation. Equation, continuity equation, and it tells you that actually the charge is conserved. So the statement about conservation of charge. Okay, this is a repetition for everybody, I think, right? Yeah. Okay, that's good. So I know I'm going through this quickly. So I think it's still useful to repeat this. So you know how this goes is that, well, you define the charge, which will be integral over some spatial volume V. So I have, okay, J over some, you know, three-dimensional surface. So it's a spatial volume. Well, that's my charge. And then you look at what happens with dq over dt. Well, let's put a minus sign, why not? So this is minus, and so by definition, oh, sorry, what am I writing? You should have stopped me. Sorry for that. Rho dv, of course. Yeah. Sorry for that. That wouldn't make any sense, right? So now rho depends on x and t. So if we go, actually, we pull the time derivative inside the integral, the total derivative becomes a partial derivative. Okay, so it'll be d rho over dt dv. And then using the continuity equation, d rho over dt minus is divergence of j. So this is integral over sigma. This is still integral over sigma, but now divergence of j dv. And finally, you can use the Stokes theorem or some other theorem. Well, it's a Stokes theorem anyway. So this is equal to an integral over the boundary of sigma, and then j times ds. Okay, so that's the area over the boundary. So what's happening here is that I have some three-dimensional thing, sigma here, and then I have d sigma. And okay, very good. So and then you have j going through this d sigma. So that's your j going like that. And so the thing is that if there is no flux through the boundary, you know, which would actually cause your charge to start escaping from the volume sigma, right? So this would be equal to zero. So zero if no flux through the boundary. And so if there is no flux through here, then your charge inside that volume is conserved, right? And so it just, you know, it's one-to-one correspondence to your continuity equation. All right. So this is great. And this is precisely, you know, what led Maxwell to include this second term in the equation number one. So before Maxwell, the Maxwell equations basically were all known, except that one term over here, this minus d over dt. So this is the contribution of Maxwell, if you want. And he just said, well, without this term, the Maxwell equations look ugly. They don't look symmetric. They look ugly. But moreover, we know that the charge is conserved and there's a continuity equation. But of course, if you look at the derivation here, then, you know, the conservation of charge, you definitely, you know, need this term here, right? Without this term, the charge is not conserved. You would have that d rho over dt is equal to zero or something like that, which was known that it's not true. So he just said, well, let's make them more symmetric. Let's make them so that actually they are consistent with the continuity equation and with the conservation of charge. And so that's it. That's amazing. So it's just, you know, that, well, that's a theoretical thing. And of course, there's many predictions coming from here. So one of them is that, you know, the continuity equation is now consistent, and it's a consequence of Maxwell equations. All right? Yes?
When you're doing the full derivative of with respect to time,
yes,
the derivative inside the integral, where did you lose the partials with respect to space?
So the q here, so what is this, right? So rho is a function of t and x, and dv is just d3x, right? So that's how the charge is defined. So if you integrate over x, you end up with a quantity which is time dependent, q of t, right? So now here I'm writing dq over dt, meaning I'm just, you know, interested in how the time evolves here, right? But the x here is just a dummy variable. It's just where the charge is distributed, right? So then if I move this inside the integral, I still have sort of like a total time derivative because it doesn't touch my x, But people write it like d rho over dt partial, because in principle, rho depends on x as well. So just to remember that, basically.
The other way to say it, I think, would have been to just expand the derivative outside the integral dx, but the dx of an integral that is not dependent on cornices is 0.
If you like. Yeah, that's another alternative way saying that. Very good. So we have this beautiful result that now Maxwell equations actually imply charge conservation. Yes?
If we assume that the space that we're talking about moves or vibrates or something, will this equation, we will have to change the equation?
Sorry, which equation?
Let's assume that sigma is not stationary and it moves through time, then wouldn't we have to make some variation in the dv?
Well, maybe, you know, this whole calculation would be much more complicated, right? But what is really important for you is, like, is the charge flowing out of the boundary which you are thinking about, right? So that's the most important thing. And if it's not flowing, the charge will be conserved. If it is flowing through, it won't be conserved, right? So that's the most important thing. You can make the boundary dynamical and so on, and the calculation will be more complicated, but the physical meaning is clear. Okay? Very good. So now, second remark. So second is like, you know, how many equations do we really have? Maxwell equations. And this is where it gets actually quite complicated. And not so straightforward. So how many equations do we have? If you look at the Maxwell equations, we have 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, some of them are, how many equations are there? 8. Why there are 8?
The two first are 3, all each. So, and the second two are just 2.
Exactly. So the last two equations are scalar equations. It's just, you know, one equation basically, whereas the first two equations are vector equations, and so you have 3 and 3 and 1 and 1. So we seem to have like 8 equations. What are the unknowns?
The fields.
Yeah. The fields. How many of those? 4, 6 unknowns. E and B. And let me write the vector here so that it's clear that we have 6 of those. So what's going on? Isn't this screwed up? Huh?
They shouldn't be independent here.
Uh-huh. That's good.
The last two equations are constrained equations.
Exactly. Very good. So that's the right answer. So the statement basically is that, well, if you look, well, you can understand Maxwell equations from many perspectives. But one perspective is, you know, I understand them as evolution equations for my fields. I fix fields, you know, at some instant of time, and, you know, my equations better tell me how the fields look like later on. Right? So now if you look at these equations here, it's obvious that only the first and the second equation contains some time derivatives. It's a true evolution equation, right? Whereas the other two equations don't seem to have that, right? So the mystery here is really that only 1 and 2 are true evolution equations. And then somebody said, well, the other two are actually constraints. Well, let's look at what constraints they are. So for that, let me take, well, which one I want to do first doesn't matter. Let me take divergence of 2. So let's do, so let's play with that, and then let's do divergence of 2. Well, if you look at the divergence of 2, then we have divergence of curl is automatically 0 by the identity. So we have 0. So this is equal to 0 plus, and then again, I swap partial time derivative with the divergence, and so I'll have d over dt divergence of b. over dt divergence of B equals to zero. And similarly, if you did this for one, well, if we do divergence of one, then we have divergence of curl is zero. It's minus d over dt, divergence of E, minus d over dt, divergence of E, and it's equal to 4 pi divergence of J, which is exactly the same calculation as we were doing before, right? So now we just do it the other way around. Let's say that we know that the charge is conserved, right? So this is 4 pi rho, and this is the continuity equation, right? Is that what I want to do? Yes, probably.
Also, another rationale for that would be that in the equation for curl of E, we have the freedom for the divergence of E. So the curl is always zero. We have to have that constraint.
Say it again.
For example, equation 2 says the curl of E is equal to minus dV dt. And we have some sort of freedom for the divergence of any sort of vector, and we set that in equation 3. So the constraint gives us the freedom.
Sort of. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So let me finish this calculation. Right. So the divergence of 2 gives us t over dt divergence of b equals to 0. The divergence of 1 gives us, this is that, this is 4 pi rho. Now, if I use the continuity equation here, I get that. So I can group the terms, which are like d over dt, divergence of E is a minus sign over here. And then there will be a plus sign, so minus 4 pi rho equals to 0. Right? So I'm getting this equation, and I'm getting that equation. Right? But if you look at these equations here, they are precisely equations 3 and 4, except they are now time differentiated, right? So this equation is precisely the equation 3. That equation is precisely equation 4, but now with d over dt in front of that. So in some sense, the equations 1 and 2 already know about 3 and 4. But the 3 and 4, they sort of fix like initial values for this thing here. So basically, 3 is, I know from 1 and 2 that, d over dt divergence of B has to be equal to 0. And simply equation 4 tells me, at the beginning, when there was a big bang or something like that, and we created our universe, actually we created it in such a way that divergence of B was equal to 0. And then, this just makes sure that this divergence of B remains 0 in all later times. All right, so in some sense, 3 and 4, 3 and 4 can be understood as initial conditions. Or 1 and 2. And 2. And so really it seems like our universe was formed in a way that there are electric charges. That's why divergence of, when it was created, there were lots of electric charges. So we had, non-trivial divergence of E. But there were no magnetic charges. So that's why we have divergence of B equal to 0, right? And if this was true at the beginning, then these equations make sure that it will be true in any time later on. Questions? So this is all, yeah?
Conditions, we also use the continuity equation.
Yeah. So for that, you need to use the continuity equation. So it's a little bit cheating, right? Because I just showed you. Exactly. Now it's a little bit cheating. Yeah, I agree. So that's why it's complicated, right? It's but it's almost true.
Should we say that Maxwell's equations plus continuity equation?
Yeah. So that would be a more precise statement. But what you also want, is that, the statement is would be like 1, 2 plus continuity equation.
Yeah.
It gives you 3, 4 as initial conditions.
Yeah.
Or you could say 1, 2, 3, 4 gives me continuity equation as a consequence of them. But yeah, and then you have too many equations for yeah. So it is slightly complicated. All right. So now, very good. So we have this. So now let me discuss something, the most amazing thing. You know, just, you know, Maxwell playing with these equations and just adding this d over dt term. And that really, you know, that was the breakthrough everybody was waiting for. And that's basically, you know, the origin of modern physics. So let's call it Maxwell triumph. Okay, so Maxwell's triumph. And what is really the big deal is that without this term, if you have no sources, then there is no electromagnetic fields. Okay, but once you include this term, strange things start happening, and actually the field starts having degrees of freedom on its own. Okay, and so that's really the thing. So now again, you know, to show that, I will need two identities. Well, one identity, and that is curl of any vector can be written as gradient of the divergence of that vector minus Laplace square acting on that vector, sometimes a Laplace operator. Okay, so that's an identity which we're gonna use. All right, and so let's do it for, let's say, equation two. It's simpler. So let's do curl on equation of two. So we have curl of E. Curl of E, and then we have plus d over dt curl of B equals to zero. But curl of B from one, so, and then I'm you know, considering J and rho equal to zero, so I'm killing the sources, okay? So the curl of B is just D over dt, this thing here, just D over dt, and this thing here, by applying this wonderful identity, is gradient of divergence of E minus Laplace square acting on E. But divergence of E is zero in the absence of sources. Okay, so this guy is zero. And so then we have a beautiful thing, is that the box acting on E is equal to zero, where the box operator is just minus d square over dt square plus Laplace square is the wave operator. Okay, so now we see that the electric intensity satisfies the wave equation. And if you do the same thing, but now on one, you would also find that this is true. That also the magnetic field satisfies the wave equation. And so this is so amazing, right? So you know, many remarks here. So even in the absence of sources, of course, wave equations have non-trivial solutions, and so we have non-trivial electromagnetic fields. We can have non-trivial, you know, wave solutions. right? So we just predicted electromagnetic waves. And then we know that electromagnetic waves are very important for us. We wouldn't be watching TV, right? That would be a disaster. Right? So you know, this is a huge discovery, right? We just discovered electromagnetic waves. So this is a discovery. Discovery of EM waves. Okay. Well, that's amazing. But we have done something much more than just that. We have discovered how fast these waves actually travel. Well, they travel at the speed of light, which is hiding here. What should be actually sitting here if I had normal CI units or whatever, SI units, then there will be C squared here, right? So we just predicted the speed of light, right? So we predicted speed of light. In our case, that it's equal to 1, all right? So we just you know, discovered that the electromagnetic waves will propagate at that speed. Very good. But, of course, this speed was very well known in Maxwell times in the 1860s, right? And so people knew how fast light travels, right? And now this guy comes and he says, well, electromagnetic waves travel at that speed as well. Okay, so what is light? Finally, we know it's an electromagnetic wave. So they basically, at this point, people unified two completely separate branches of physics. You know, the optics and whatever, the light physics with electromagnetism. Right? So this was the first realization that light is an electromagnetic wave. Okay, so that would be definitely worth Nobel Prize, right? If the Nobel Prize existed then. Maybe even Fields Medal, I don't know. but we are still not done. It's a miracle here, 1860, right? If you look at, you know, we predicted some, you know, constant speed, right? We predicted a speed out of the theory, right? This is incompatible with Galilean transformation. If you have Galilean physics, then you actually add speeds, right? If you add speeds, there cannot be any preferred speed whatsoever, because you know I just add to it and I you know move and you know I couldn't do that, right? So we just basically made Galilean physics invalid, and so there is a different symmetry to Maxwell equations. Then the Galilean symmetry is the Lorentz symmetry, the Lorentz invariant. And so we are immediately led to special relativity. So the very existence of C, which is, you know, an absolute predicted velocity, breaks the Galilean invariance. Breaks well Galilean physics or whatever. And so, in some sense, you are immediately led to Lorentz transformations and to special relativity. If you look at, you know, what transformations leave Maxwell equations invariant, and we will do it in, you know, next week or whatever, not next week, but the week after that, leads to Lorentz transformations and special relativity. Of course, people did not realize immediately in the 1860s, right? It took another 45 years to realize that this is the case, and the special relativity was invented later. But this is a direct consequence of this Maxwell's work.
I thought how the Galilean, let's say, symmetry of speeds is broken here here, but I didn't get exactly.
Yeah.
There is a speed that is present in the wave equation, but how exactly do you expand that to light? You said light is an electromagnetic wave.
Oh, it's just what else it would be, right? So it moves at the same velocity. So what else it would be? So that's the simplest argument.
Okay. But it could be something else that moves.
It could be something else that moves at the speed of But you know, that's of course that was a hypothesis, right? That it is an electromagnetic wave, and then you have to prove it, right? But you know.
So
it was the first step that light physics is not separate from electromagnetism, right? So that's what actually intrigued.
But there is a gap here, I think, because someone said, we have the same speed as the speed of light, therefore they're the same thing.
Yeah.
So
it's an educated guess, right? It's an educated guess. And that's what's awarded in physics, right? You don't need to really prove hard things and stuff like that. You just need to do educated guesses and be right. Right?
Still, there would be space for people who would disagree at this point.
Of course. No, I agree. Sure. But actually, I don't think anybody disagreed.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I know vacuum equations are linear, so I guess you can't really add them up in any direction, but is that actually, is there some way in which you can say, oh yes, I have a light wave here, and it interacts directly with the with like an electrostatic configuration of something here, or do you have to see electrons wiggle or something?
I don't quite understand the question. So do you?
That's like refraction. The light will interact with the matter, and then.
Oh, the light interacts with the matter.
Yeah.
I'm satisfied.
Thanks.
The identity on the double curl.
Yeah.
Is it dependent on the dimensions of the space, or is it generalizable?
Well, all these identities, with the cross there, right? It's a three-dimensional cross. It's a, it's like a vector product, right? Or what is it? Yeah, it must be a vector product, and that's only valid in some sense in three dimensions. So then you can generalize this to higher dimensions. But then the only true Stokes theorem is that this one here, right? And it's a very, very simple way how to remember that. So the only Stokes theorem there is that you differentiate something and you integrate it over some domain omega, right? And so there's 1D here, so you need to still have 1D on the other side. But now the D disappears from omega, but it goes here, okay? So that's the Stokes theorem. And that, of course, is true in any number of dimensions. And it reduces to all these that's the integration, and then you have a okay, sorry, so this is the Stokes theorem, which is true in any number of dimensions, and the identities which we are writing here is that basically d square acting on omega is equal to zero, d of omega is equal to zero, and then these identities take various versions in various for various forms and for various dimensions and stuff like that. But these are the two things which you need to know. But the nice cross thing here, it will be only in three dimensions.
Another question is there a way to view Maxwell's theory as a boundary valley problem? Is there a way to recast it as?
Well, you certainly so once you start evolving things, well, initial value problem is in some sense boundary value problem in space time, right? Okay. I wouldn't too distinguish between space and time here. So in the same sense, everybody is happy with saying that, if you understand time evolution things, I specify something on the boundary and I evolve in time, and nobody's surprised that I know what's happening here, right? If I specify something here. Everybody is surprised when you have ADS CFT. When you specify something on the boundary here, and then you evolve from the boundary to the bulk, and then it's a surprise that you can recover bulk from the boundary. In some sense, it's just an initial value problem put on a side, right? And so I wouldn't distinguish too much between the two.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 of course, you know, there may be some difficulties, but all right. So amazing Max Wahlström, right? And so then Maxwell went to Cambridge and he enjoyed his life and he never did anything else. Right, that's not true. He did some amazing stuff still, but all right. We still have time. Okay, so far we have been discussing Maxwell's theory in terms of these, you know, fields E and B. But the truth is that you can also do a different description in terms of the vector and scalar potentials. And so at the classical level, this is just a tool for your convenience, if you want. At the quantum level, these phi and A actually could have some observational effects, like Aharonov Ohm effect and these things. So let me briefly discuss these electromagnetic potentials. Okay. And so they are like in classical theory, they are a convenient tool. Okay. And so the observation is very simple. So I look at divergence of B equals to zero. And I know that this equation, do I still have the identity somewhere? I just probably deleted it. So anyway, this equation will be automatically satisfied if you say B is a curl of some vector A. Okay, so 4 is automatically satisfied. If I set B equals to curl of some vector A, and then I have, you know, divergence of curl is equal to zero, and so we are done with this equation 4. So now, if you look at 2 with this knowledge, then you have that curl of E. Plus d over dt curl of A is equal to zero. So we can group the terms together. So this is a curl of E plus dA over E dt equals to zero. And now I use my second favorite identity, that curl of gradient is equal to zero. So if I set this thing here, over here, equal to, and I think it's traditionally it's minus gradient phi, then this will be automatically satisfied. Okay, so in other words, I will have E is equal to minus dA over dt minus gradient of phi. And so then 2 is also automatically satisfied. Okay, so it's a convenient tool how to solve 2 out of the 4 equations. You just, instead of E and B, we introduce new things, phi and A. Right? Okay, so we introduced phi and A. Phi and A instead of E and B. Well, that's already a great improvement, right? Because we now have 4 quantities, a scalar phi and the vector A, instead of 6 E and B. So that's already a great improvement. But it's actually even better than that, right? So if you think about that E and B are physical quantities and phi and A are just tools, the question is, are these tools actually uniquely defined by these things? And of course, they are not uniquely defined. There's a gauge transformation I can do on phi and A. And it gives me some advantage. So there is a gauge freedom, gauge degree of freedom. Okay, so I can go from phi to phi minus dt of any function of lambda. And if I go from a to a plus gradient of that same function lambda, then E and B do not change. Okay, very simple to see for B. I have curl of A. I started with plus curl of gradient of lambda. That's precisely the freedom I have in inverting this relation. And so B remains the same. And similarly, you can check that E remains the same under this freedom. And so what it means is that basically, well, I seem to have four quantities, phi and A, but I have this one function lambda, which I can actually, you know, choose to fix one of these four quantities, phi and a. And the convenient choice, which we'll be using most of the time, is the Lorentz gauge. So can impose, for example, the Lorentz gauge and that's the guy without t. Maybe. and that would be like dt of phi plus divergence of a equals to zero. So how this is done is that, well, you just start with any phi and a, and you calculate what this guy is, dt of that phi and divergence of that a is. And you'll find something on the right-hand side, some function. And so then you say, well, now I changed the gauge, and I, you know, you plug now for phi minus dt of lambda, and for a plus gradient of lambda. And so then you get a function for lambda. Then you get an equation for lambda, and you can always solve that equation for the lambda so that, you know, this guy is zero now. Okay. Okay. So what it means is actually that instead of 4 degrees of freedom, there should be 3 degrees of freedom, because you're basically killing 1 degree of freedom by the change by the choice of the gauge. Okay. However, that's not true if you have no sources. If there are no sources, there is still some residual gauge freedom, even after fixing the Lorentz gauge. And so that actually allows you to kill one more degree of freedom. And so in the end, you end up with two degrees of freedom of vacuum fields, phi and a, and they correspond to two polarizations of the photon. Okay, so if in vacuum, meaning rho and j are equal to zero, if in vacuum, meaning rho equal to zero equal to j, there remains still some gauge freedom. And so you can kill one more degree of, so you can kill one more component or whatever, one more degree of freedom. So we end up with two true degrees of freedom for the electromagnetic field, and they correspond to two polarizations of electromagnetic waves. At the classic level, or, you know, two. Phase of the photon. Okay. Yes.
What's the additional degree of
freedom? Okay. So the statement is, I can still do some additional, you know, transformations like this. So, you know, I have done one lambda, so that I achieve that this is true. Okay. But the statement is, I can still do this transformation, preserving this equation. So you know, basically what you end up with is, you know, some differential equation, some differential operator acting on lambda is equal to, you know, whatever this was equal to at the beginning. So now you solve this, but you know that typically these equations have solution where, you know, I find a special solution of this equation where this is really equal to f, and then I can add to that any solution of homogeneous equation. Where, you know, I have d lambda equals to zero, right? You are precisely using that extra freedom in this homogeneous equation to kill extra degree of freedom of phi and a, right? So even after solving this equation for lambda, I can still add this homogeneous solution for lambda, and that can be used to kill the extra degree of freedom.
Why is that not true when there's source?
That's a good question. Why is that not true? Certainly not true. So, for example, you know, if you have, you know, electromagnetic waves propagating in medium or, you know, through the metal or something like that, you really have three polarizations, right? So you know, your electromagnetic waves are perpendicular to the direction of propagation. But if you are in matter, actually, you still have the extra longitudinal mode. So it's certainly true that you cannot do that. I don't see why you cannot do it at this point. I don't know. It's a good point. Well, we know this is true, so it's true. All right, so let me generalize the statement. How much time do we have? What is this? Well, we started 11:15, right? So we have still lots of time. That's great. All right, so let me generalize the statement of 2 degrees of freedom. And I will give you a very general theorem, which you should remember for the rest of your life, because it's very useful. To prove it, it's more complicated. Of course, you can prove it in specific cases. And I personally was never convinced by this argument of, you know, df or d lambda or equals to f or whatever. It's a very nice way how to prove it. It's in light cone gauge. You can read about it in Zwiebach's string theory book, where you actually, you know, choose proper coordinates and you choose things, and then you see how the degrees of freedom actually start disappearing one by one. Okay, and you can really explicitly construct what the true degrees of freedom for any field are in that gauge. So that's a very beautiful way how to do that. Maybe you'll do it in gravitational physics later on in the course. So let me give you this very general theorem. Statement in field theory, and that is that if you have gauge theory, so this is a gauge theory because we have the gauge freedom here, right? So in any gauge theory, and now there's a magic formula, okay? So the number of true degrees of freedom and is equal to the number of apparent degrees of freedom minus magic number 2. Okay. 2 times the degrees of freedom of gauge function. The magic number 2 is precisely the 2 somebody asked me last time about the Liouville's theorem or something like that, that you can use every integral of motion twice. So that's the same thing. Basically, you can use any gauge degree of freedom twice, and that reduces the number of 2 degrees of freedom. So by, you know, 2 times like that. So let me give you an example, right? So this is the general statement. Hopefully the example, well, 2 examples. Well, we already have seen one. Elucidate what's going on here. So example, and but you can study more complicated cases, right? But so in Maxwell, so we have, you know, Maxwell theory described in terms of potentials phi and a, right? So there are 4 apparent degrees of freedom. It seems like we have a scalar and we have a vector, so there's like 4 quantities which we need to specify. Okay, so then we know that these fields, however, they are not really physical. There is a gauge freedom to these fields, and so we can go from phi to phi minus. I'm writing the same thing here, dt lambda and a to a plus gradient of lambda, and so there's a gauge function here, gauge function. It's a function, scalar 1, so it has 1 degree of freedom because it's a function. And so our magic formula gives us that, you know, the true number of degrees of freedom of Maxwell field should be, so number of Maxwell is just 4 minus 2 times 1 equals to 2, which we already know. Okay, yes?
Where did the vacuum fit into here?
Okay, so basically when you talk about the 2 degrees of freedom of the field, what you are really interested in is, can the field propagate on its own? Does it have any, you know, internal degrees of freedom? Can it do anything on its own? Right? Once you start putting sources and matter and stuff like that, the question is not really, you know, a meaningful one, sort of. Because, you know, the field is now sort of supported by the presence of the charges and stuff like that. And so people don't really discuss degrees of freedom once you are in matter and once you have the, you know, charges supporting that and so on. But the truth is, yes, I can have 3 polarizations, sort of electromagnetic waves, once you are in matter.
Is it interesting to then, like, ask this question of 2D fields? And you can say that better. Like, is there a nice analogy?
Yeah.
There's any gauge of theories.
So this will be any gauge theory.
Yeah, so what is gauge?
So gauge theory is something which is a gauge degree of freedom. So gauge degree of freedom is basically like, well, I don't know. So there's this local symmetry to your fields, right? So now I'm changing my a and phi, you know, by something. But this lambda is a space time function. So it's not a constant or something like that. It's not a global symmetry of the theory, if you want. It's a local one. I'm you know, choosing lambda. The symmetry is there, but it's only locally. It's a function.
Theory has a local symmetry.
It's a local symmetry, so it's a gauge theory. Yes.
Do you have any intuition for why this is 2 generally, not just like, I understand in this example, we can use it twice, but why is it always true that the gauge function can be used?
Does it
twice
relate to the integrals of motion that you did last time, and you said the flow, if the Poisson bracket of I is generating with the function that generates the flow is zero, so is the reverse. And if one of them if one of them generates a symmetry in a certain flow, the reverse generates another symmetry in the corresponding flow.
And so that's certainly true. That's certainly true there. I would say it's more related to the choice, like, you know, really the one integral of motion chose, you know, reduces where the motion can happen by one dimension, but the other integral of motion, well, but then I just have to choose where I start on this torus or where I start on the ellipse. And so that's like a trivial constant of motion. So really it's like you can use it twice. You will see explicitly how this can be, you know, done in this, you know, in this very particular gauge, and you'll see that it's so beautiful, and then you explicitly see the degrees of freedom reducing. I don't know. but basically, what gauge theory is? Let me return back to your question. It's really, you're writing down a theory, and for the description of the theory, you are using, you know, some variables, right? But what is specific about gauge theory is that these variables not necessarily, you know, correspond to the true degrees of freedom. You are actually choosing a description, redundant description. You're choosing, you're overkilling it. You're putting more variables than there are degrees of freedom, right? And the reason why you are choosing that is that the theory then looks nice. And you can always fix the gauge to actually discover what the true degrees of freedom are anyway. And then, you know, you can always specify, you know, what the phi is and so on, but it's basically to have a nice theory. Gauge theories are really, you know, great advance, you know, great invention, but the idea is that, like, overkilling it. I am just using, you know, bigger description than the physics is there. Yes.
So about the general statement of the theory, two questions. The first one is, does it depend on the dimension of the space? And the second one is, just to clarify, is it only true for sourceless theories?
So again, so I would only talk about true degrees of freedom of the field without the absence of, well, without the sources, because with the sources, it's hard to say what really, you know, is the field independent from the sources? I don't know. But, you know, if you can delete, well, if you have no sources and still the field carries, you know, some degrees of freedom, you can still have some waves and stuff like that. You know, I would call that true degrees of freedom, and so this is what it is about. The statement is independent of number of dimensions. What really matters is the dimensionality of the gauge function, right? So now this statement is proved in some blue book by somebody on quantum field theory. So search for a blue book on quantum field theory, and there will be a general proof of this statement. There was another question.
So for a gravitational wave propagating in a certain, like, fixed direction, like some null vector, I think, like, your metric is going to have 10 apparent degrees of freedom. So what gets you down to the two polarizations?
Oh, very good. So this is my second example. Thank you so much you just provided the motivation for the second example. That's a second simple example to do. So second example would be gravitational field. Gravity, and so you will learn that the gravitational field is described by the metric. So the gravitational field described by metric . Okay, let's make it more complicated, okay? So let's do it in D number of dimensions, okay? So described by metric. So the metric is a symmetric rank 2 tensor. So if you swap the two indices, it's like a symmetric matrix, right? It's the same, right? So if you are in D number of dimensions, in D number of space-time dimensions, this is my stupid joke. I was teaching a course on statistical physics, And of course, in statistical physics, you never talk about space-time. You always only talk about spatial dimensions, right? So you don't care about time in statistical physics. But I was giving them like the number of space-time dimensions, and they calculated, and they were puzzled that it's actually off. But they never realized that I'm talking about space-time dimensions and not spatial dimensions. Stupid. Anyway, so in the number of space-time dimensions, how many number of apparent degrees of freedom do we have? How many number of components a matrix which is symmetric and is a D times D matrix? How many components does it have?
D plus one.
Perfect. So number of apparent degrees of freedom is D times D plus one over two. Okay. So that's the first step. So we determined first thing. So now, what is the gauge freedom? So the statement is gravity will be a gauge theory. There's a huge gauge freedom, which basically tells you, well, I can change arbitrary coordinates, and there will be a freedom of my thing. So now you can think about changing coordinates is that, well, I have basically like coordinates x mu, and I can do it infinitesimally. So I go from x mu plus some delta x mu. What is this delta x mu? Well, what else it would be? An epsilon times some vector xi mu. Okay, so this would be basically my freedom in the description of general relativity. I can do this diffeomorphism or coordinate transformation, and consequently nothing depends on this. This is a symmetry of gravity. So interestingly enough, this coordinate transformation induces how the metric changes under the coordinate transformation. So if I change the coordinates like that, the metric, the components of the metric, this guy here, g mu, will also change. How will they change? Is that they change from g mu to g mu, and now see the parallel with the Maxwell theory. Nabla mu psi nu plus nabla nu psi mu. Well, this is the same vector here, okay? And this is some kind of derivative, okay? It's a covariant derivative, but it's, so anyway, so that's your gauge transformation. How the components of the metric do change, precisely like how the phi and a change. You see, there's some differential operator acting on lambda. So now we have some differential operator acting on xi. Okay, so xi mu is my gauge degree of freedom, and it is a vector, right? It's a vector. It has an index. It must be a vector. So how many components does it have? D. It's a vector, right? It has D components. Okay. So very good. So our magic formula gives us that the number of true degrees of freedom of gravitational degrees of freedom, is equal to D times D plus 1 over 2 minus the magic number 2 times D. Well, no, I don't know what that is. Well, anyway, that can be somehow simplified. Okay, in four dimensions, okay, what do we have?
Two.
Okay, very good. So this gives you 10 minus 8, so it gives you 2 in d equal to 4. Okay, how many in d equal to 5?
4.
Uh-huh. So this is 5 in d equal to 5. So what it means is that actually, there's many theories which assume that our universe is more dimensional than four dimensional, right? So if you have, so in four-dimensional world, we just have two polarizations of the graviton, or two polarizations of gravitational waves. They squeeze things like that, or they squeeze things like that, right? If you actually lived in five dimensions, which is what people play with, the idea, then you would have suddenly five polarizations. It would be much more complicated. Okay, much more complicated. What about, let's just make fun, right? What about three dimensions?
Zero.
Aha. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's equal to zero in d equal to 3. Hey, let me make fun of your colleague. So you will have a nice course on quantum gravity later on in the year. So the course is actually done by quantizing gravity in three dimensions. So you will spend the whole course quantizing gravity in three dimensions. And then at the end you say, well, the same thing will be true in four dimensions, but we don't really know how to do that. But what we just seen here is that in three dimensions, there's no degrees of freedom. There are no gravity does not propagate in three dimensions. That's what people say. There's no any degrees of freedom whatsoever in gravity in three dimensions. So you are quantizing something in three dimensions, but it's not gravity. Okay? That's not entirely true. There are some topological degrees of freedom. But you know, there is no gravitons in three dimensions. That's for certainly true. Okay? Quantum gravity, yeah. Take the course, please. Yes.
So what does 5 degrees of freedom actually look like? Because the 2 is like you've got your 2 eigen-like functions or eigenvectors of space, and it's like stretch, compress, right? But
the answer is
as many as the number of dimensions in your space-time. What does that even?
Yeah, mean? The answer is I don't remember, but I can refer you to a paper where this is discussed, for example. Yeah. So it must be fun. I'm sure it must be fun that it's, you know, what does the gravitational wave do? If you have, you know, ring of test particles in 5 dimensions, you know, as the wave passes by, what does it do to the particles? I can refer you to a paper if I can remember that. Okay, very good. So this very useful theorem here, right? So we applied it to Maxwell, we applied it to gravity, to general relativity, but you can apply it to any gauge theory. So if you have more complicated, you know, gauge fields in string theory, whatever. You have higher forms, you just don't have Maxwell, but you have higher forms, and there are still gauge theories and so on. So you can still apply this beautiful theorem here to calculate the number of degrees of freedom of this theory. Yes?
Where is the statement that you wrote for the gauge freedom? Where did it come from?
It can be proved.
Yeah. In what context, I mean?
I think it can be even, well, I always seen it proved like case by case, and then said, well, because it works case by case, it's actually general, which is the attitude I like. But you know, it can be proved generally, and I don't remember how this is done.
What do you mean by general, though? I mean, assuming quantum field theory.
Yeah.
Okay,
so search for blue quantum field theory book,
okay.
And it will be discussed there. Okay.
Zero. I'm trying to say that maybe that equation, or maybe someone would take issue with the above equation rather than the that being zero. So I'm trying to say that maybe some people who are doing quantum gravity in three dimensions justify that by saying that equation is not right.
But actually, it is right. So it is right. No, but they still, I was trying to be nasty, but there is still something to quantize, and it's the topological degrees of freedom you can have in three dimensions. And, you know, people quantize that, basically. But it's not really gravity, right? So the gravity is graviton, right? And then that does not exist in three dimensions, okay? Okay, I think I'm done, right? Okay, let me stop here. Thank you.